Okay, this is photography and the art of doing it wrong. These first couple images that I'll go through, they span various time periods in the history of photography. All of them have something that at least at one point was considered a flaw or something wrong. So I'll just go through these pretty quickly and then get on with the talk. Okay, so first I should explain what exactly I mean by doing it wrong. By this I mean going outside of the standard way of doing something, in this case photography. When photography started, there was no established tradition of photography since it was new. So for a while, they kind of adopted the language of painting and other visual art. But that didn't quite work because it's not the same medium. In painting, someone is putting pigment on a canvas or whatever surface. In photography, light is hitting a surface and causing a chemical change to occur. So they don't really line up, even though they both create a two-dimensional image. The overlap isn't complete. So over the history of photography, a tradition established itself. And we started to get a sense of what was right and what was wrong in photography. There's standard ways of making an image. If I say certain styles of creating an image, you'll all have some idea of what that is. Like a portrait, you probably all imagine a photograph of a person, probably including the face. A landscape is probably a horizontal image, including some elements of outside. And there are methods established for creating these images. But to do anything new, to expand the language of photography, you have to work outside of those. Are these on feedback? Okay, is it better now? Okay. All right, so when you follow a prescribed method in doing something like photography, it's hard to really learn anything new or to really know that you know what you're doing, which brings me to the concept of fluency. We understand what fluency means in terms of a spoken language. You can express your ideas without the language being clunky and getting in your way. I'm not really worried that when I'm speaking English that the language is going to fail and my thoughts won't get across. The same should be true of whatever artistic medium you decide to work in. But how do you become fluent in something? You have to know what the medium is capable of, where and how it fails, and if it is going to fail, how to use those failures for expressive means, and choose the medium according to what your message is. Every medium has limitations. And there's this cat and girl, a comic from the internet. And in the middle he says there, what if there was a medium without limitations? And she responds saying, that's called life. So in life, there really aren't these limitations that occur in an art medium. Choosing a medium to work in is choosing a set of limitations that can better frame your message. So I already started talking a little bit about painting and photography being different things. When photography first came about, people talked about the death of painting. Nobody was going to paint anymore because why would they? You can create an image very quickly using light and chemicals. But it's about 170 years later, and people still paint. And why is that? Well, painting and photography are different. And they diverged a bit after both of them became more established in the same space. If something needed to be super realistic, people would choose photography instead for a more, obviously painterly kind of expression, or less realistic, less natural. People would use painting. And there's many reasons to choose one or the other, and I won't go too far into that, but the difference in those causes people to choose one or the other. And in photography itself, we can go further with that. Why choose black and white for some images, and why use color? And with digital cameras becoming much more prevalent in the past bunch of years, people were saying originally that digital was going to replace film. Plenty of photographers still use film. Plenty of photographers have recently picked up film again, despite not having used it for years. It's because they are different mediums. Film is a physical thing, and what happens with the film when it's exposed is different than what happens with a sensor. The artifacts are different. Film is physical. It can be scratched. It can be damaged. And you can use those things on purpose in the final photograph. And in digital, there's artifacts like JPEG compression. And some images that I have later on, like a corrupted CF card. But all of this gets discovered kind of by accident, by exploring. So discovery and understanding through failure. You're trying to do something, and it doesn't work exactly as you thought it would. So strictly speaking, that could be a failure. But with a little bit of curiosity and maybe exploring that further, you can do it intentionally and use this on purpose. Going back to the beginning again, 1826, this photograph by Niepce, the first photograph that survives today, this is taken out of a window, and it's an 8-hour exposure. It took 8 hours for light hitting the surface of this to change the color of those areas, or change the tone because it's black and white. This is before they discovered development. Which brings me to this one by Daguerre. Taken a few years later, Daguerre was an assistant to Niepce. They worked together on their research in photography. This image was taken in 10 minutes instead of 8 hours. So something happened in that time between. And one of the things that happened was Daguerre broke a thermometer. It was full of mercury. And it was in a closet. He had some underexposed plates, and he put them in that closet. A few days later, he comes back to them and sees that there's an image on them now. He finds the broken thermometer and eventually concludes that it was the mercury vapor that caused the chemical change that brought out the image. It was this mistake that allowed the exposure time to go down from 8 hours to 10 minutes, which makes it a much more viable art form. This is a close-up of that image, and this is the first person ever photographed. He was having his shoes shined and stood still for the full 10 minutes of the exposure. So It was the middle of the day, probably a busy street. There were plenty of people walking by, but they didn't stay still long enough for their image to remain on the plate. So, a broken thermometer and a guy standing still to get his shoes shined, and we have this. So, at the same time as Daguerre, Talbot was working in England on his own process of photography. This is a photograph of a window. So, an easy way of getting photographs in those early days was pointing the camera directly at a light source. That way you're sure that light is going to hit the surface. And this one is reversed. It's a negative. So, not strictly as representative as Daguerre's process, it's harder to read this image because we don't see in negative. But because Talbot was working on paper, he was able to do this. He took the negative image and put it on top of another sensitized piece of paper and exposed it to light. The light filtering through that paper and through the other image created a positive image. This was very important for photography going any further because now they could make copies of a photo. And Talbot also discovered the development of a latent image through a mistake. He was trying to reuse a piece of paper that failed. It was underexposed, there was no image on it, and he was washing it with a chemical solution and the image he thought was gone forever appeared. So doing this on purpose, again, allowed his exposure times to decrease and use this in much more shorter time periods. Okay, so we're still in the 1840s here. I don't want this to stay as a history of photography lecture. That's not what I want to go on about. But in that time, photography was a lot more sloppy and chaotic than it is now. Now it seems much more refined, and pretty much anyone can pick up a camera and take photos and have them look way more natural and representative than this photograph here. But a lot of important discoveries were made in that time, and a lot of the flaws that happened in that time were later used for artistic effect. One of the examples here, I'm going to skip to this photograph. This looks really damaged and messed up. It's a daguerreotype from sometime in the 1800s. I couldn't find an exact date for when. But if you see that blue area there, that's solarization. That's a partial reversal of the tone because of extreme overexposure. This was very easy for it to happen by accident. They hadn't quite figured out the exposure times, and it also occurs if light hits the film or the photopaper as it's being developed. Very easy to like accidentally flip on a light switch in the darkroom. So I'm going to cut ahead to this, the exploitation of flaws. When things go wrong, it's important to be able to see those as an opportunity for expression. So that solarized image before, that one was just a kind of damaged thing, and they kept it anyway because that was all that came out. That was the result of that photograph, and they didn't really have the ability to do more, or time or resources or whatever. This is using that same concept. This is a photograph by Man Ray in the Surrealist period. The shadows and the highlights are getting reversed here. So Man Ray and Lee Miller, two Surrealist photographers working in the beginning of the 19th century, and the beginning of the 20th century, 1900s, and they also discovered solarization. So one day when working in the darkroom, the light came on when things were being developed and this effect happened. Instead of seeing it as just something that had gone horribly wrong and they should start over, they decided to push this and see where it went. And they were able to create this. Multiple exposure is another thing that happened. Oh, wait, I should. These came out of order somehow. This is another one by Man Ray. Also using the solarization technique. And it's most pronounced on the edges of her body, causing her to melt into her shadow. So this would have not, this photograph here would not have been possible without making that mistake before. And this one was very much on purpose. Okay, going back to this one. Multiple exposures. It's pretty easy to accidentally expose a sheet of film more than once. And even in the 1800s, they started doing this on purpose. This is an example of spirit photography. Someone realized that when the images overlap, you get this strange ghost image on top. So to kind of exploit people who are more superstitious, they brought people into the studio and had them do spirit portraits. They were photographing the people with their dead relatives. So obviously now, it's like looking at this, it's a darkroom trick. And the photographers knew this, but the subjects didn't necessarily know this, so they ended up buying these portraits of them sitting with their dear departed whoever that was. So back then they were already kind of playing on this mistake and also people's unawareness of how that mistake could happen. Okay, long exposures. This is a photograph by Michael Wesley, and it was taken in 2001 to 2003. That is the amount of time the shutter was open for this photograph. So he's a modern photographer. This was taken at the Museum of Modern Art in New York as it was being remodeled. He positioned a bunch of cameras around the museum as it was being remodeled and had the shutters open the entire time. And people had done long exposures before, and you get the effects of like light trails, and when things move or change, you get a ghost image of them. So he just kind of pushed it as far as he could and had it open for about 3 years. I heard recently that he's working on a 10-year exposure. I don't think that one's done yet. So what you see in the middle there, there was like scaffolding and other building materials that for some of the exposure they were there, for some of it wasn't. And those white streaks in the sky, that's the sun. So he really used the artifacts of a long exposure as a way of expressing himself there. And this one is another from Surrealist days, Hans Bellmer. This is a hand-colored photograph. So it was a black and white photograph, painted. And at the time that he did this, color photography was possible when this one was made. But even if it wasn't for this particular one, he continued to do this after color photography was available. So instead of using color film, he decided to paint the print because he decided that the artifact of using paint on a print was more what he wanted than using color film. Okay, the next piece is a piece that I did a couple years ago. And this was using film for its physicality. I mentioned before about how film is a physical thing. It can get damaged, it can get scratched and messed up, and then when you print from that, those things stay in the final print. This one, I set it on fire, I cracked it, scratched it, sewed it back together, and covered it in tape before printing it. You're laughing at me. So I had seen photographs before where this had happened by accident. I'm not very good at taking care of my negatives, so there were some that I needed to print, and they were messed up. I'm like, okay, well, I really want this thing, but it's scratched here, but I'm going to print it anyway. So I did, and I liked what I saw, so I did it on purpose. And then later, like after doing this, it brought me to another project of mine. This was taken at the Sedlec Ossuary in the Czech Republic on a piece of stitched film. This is strips of 35mm film sewn together with a needle and thread in complete darkness into a sheet that was about this big and shot in a large format camera. I just really liked the damage that happens to film, the very physical nature of it. And I also really liked the fine grain, high quality effect of shooting large format. So I just kind of mashed the two together, see what would happen. And I showed you multiple exposures before. That's another technique that I really liked. And I was curious to see kind of how far I could go with it. This is one of my early attempts with it. Six ships. It was taken here in Berlin last year at the Technical Museum where they have all of those model ships. I picked six of them that I liked and shot all of them on one piece of film, all overlapping. I really like the concept of layering moments of time. And the way that film works, it's only the light hitting the film that affects it. The darkness doesn't do anything to it. So you can just keep layering exposure on there, and only the light parts will overlap. So that's why in the middle there, it gets really bright, because there was a bunch of bright stuff that piled up. And I found that this worked really well for performances. This is Unwoman, a musician in San Francisco. She's a cellist. And this was another one where I did six exposures of her while she was playing. And I got the movement of her face and the movement of her arm playing the cello. I started using this technique a lot as an adaptation of really only having very slow film and shooting where there wasn't much light. So slow film, if you're not familiar with it, it means that it takes a lot more light to change the film than if it was a fast film. It also means that it has very fine grain, which I really like. So they recommend that you only shoot this in bright daylight. But I don't tend to shoot in bright daylight a lot, so something needed to happen. So I'm like, all right, I need more light to hit this. And the ways of controlling this on the camera, you either open the shutter, or you open the aperture a lot and make a much larger hole for the light to come in, or you leave the shutter open for a longer period of time. The aperture was already open all of the way, so I couldn't control that anymore. And leaving the shutter open for 4 seconds or so was not really what I wanted to do. This was handheld. And I was quite familiar with what kind of failure that would produce. I was kind of sick of just having very blurry images of, like, motion blur of an arm moving like that. So I wanted something different. And it doesn't really matter what moments of time you decide to put on the piece of film. It does, like, that the time that it's being exposed doesn't need to be continuous. So I just did multiple exposures to get the very crisp edges of having a fast exposure, but layering it to get enough to have an actual image. And just to compare, the next one is a digital photograph that I took at the same concert with a much higher ISO. So this one, there's a little bit of motion blur in her hand, but it's relative. This is like a relatively normal photograph. The color is strange because of stage lighting, but there's nothing really remarkable about this photograph. So I've come to carry two cameras most of the time, like a digital camera and a film camera. Because the film camera can do stuff that the digital camera can't. And then the digital camera can do things like this, getting the more like standard documentary style photograph that the slow film just won't do. And here's an example by somebody else doing a similar technique. This is Elliot I'm killing the name here. Elisaphone, and this is Duchamp descending a staircase, inspired by his famous painting from the early 20th century, Nude Descending a Staircase. And this looks like it was done as a long exposure, but used in a completely darkened room using a flash, just triggered multiple times. And it has a similar effect to the multiple exposure effect, just like layering little fragments of light on top of the film. And this is another one of mine using that technique in another concert and portraiture. And now I'm going to go into digital photography. And this one by Farrell Eves. He dropped his digital camera into a pond when he was at a photography workshop. And he pulled it out and like took all the pieces apart and like let them dry. And after letting that happen for a little while, put it all back together and tried to use it again. And this is what it was doing. But instead of just seeing this as a broken camera and that he was done with it, he decided to continue doing this. He has a whole gallery up online of photos that he's taken with this camera. He calls it his magic camera. Okay, and the next one is kind of similar. This is by Shalika Shing, a photographer from San Francisco. And he posted these on Flickr a little while ago from a corrupted CF card. So I saw these and immediately like, these are awesome. And people were commenting on them, saying that he should print these really big. This is something that he didn't intend this to happen. The card broke. But instead of seeing it as a flaw, instead of seeing it as something that had just entirely gone wrong, he embraced it and used it on purpose. Though he didn't do this exact one on purpose, he put it online, and the act of choosing that as a photograph was definitely on purpose. And the next one I have is by Ruben Abdi. He might be here. And he's doing something really interesting here where he's combining the strange artifacts of film and also of the HDR process. Some of you might be familiar with this. It's usually just done with digital photography because what you're doing is you're taking a whole bunch of different photographs of the same shot. So basically you set up a camera and take this photograph several different times at different exposures. And that way In one of the photos, you get really good detail in the shadow areas. Another one, you get really good detail in the midtones. Another one, really good detail in the highlights, which you can't really get in one photograph if there's a huge difference between those. So you take those, and there's software that'll do it and kind of compress it into one photo. He did this with film. He did this with film, scanned the film, and then ran it through that process. So in this photo, you're getting the film grain and also the artifacts that come along with that HDR process. So that's the last photo that I have here to show you.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. Are there any questions for you? Someone, there are two microphones. Please walk to them and ask them to Audrey.
Hello. This maybe is more of a question to anyone in the audience than to you, but I was at Fosdem in Brussels a few years back, running around with my camera like this all the time. Came to the airport, started shooting cool statues, and then I saw the passport control and the sign that says no photos here. So I tried to shoot some photos there. It turns out this is probably just by accident, but when I took the photos at the security control, I could see the roof clearly, and then just below a certain level, everything is yellow and white. Are they doing something funny? Like infrared, not ultraviolet, light, against? Because it produces a really cool effect. It's almost like that accident drop safe card.
I would like to see that. I've never heard of them doing that on purpose. And a professor of mine has this series of photos that she took in airports containing those signs that say no photography allowed here. So.
Okay, so it's not everywhere. Maybe it's just my CF card in airports.
Well,
thank you.
So a coincidence, but interesting.
Please load it up and you can check if it's a coincidence of, or maybe something else. If he loads it up, yeah?
What was that?
Uploading on the internet and then you can see what it might be. Or send it to you by email.
Yeah, I would like to see that, so send it to me.
Yeah. Next question.
So, short of dropping your nice digital camera in a pond or trying to take a photo in an airport, which obviously works really well, do you have any pointers on abusing your camera settings for creating these effects if you have no idea where to start?
I'm less familiar with working digitally than probably a lot of other people here. But what I do have to say about that is If something happens accidentally and you like the effect, try to do it on purpose. Try to do that again, and mimic the conditions that you did it on. There's some things that people have done with JPEG compression and using that on purpose. So basically, just shoot a bunch of photos and whatever you like. Just try to do that again. Try to do it on purpose. Try to emphasize the things that you like in that.
So remember really well what you did.
And if you don't, make something up.
Next question.
Yeah, thanks, Audrey. Thanks, Audrey, for your talk. And I'm thinking of starting a project you might be interested in. Because
really?
Inspired by your talk, I thought it would be interesting, because I'm considering myself a proletarian scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be good to get many, many cameras. You probably have cameras at home that you don't use because they're too old or whatever. I think it would be a good idea to do a research project about destroying cameras and finding out what they're doing, like bombarding them with microwaves or whatever, okay?
Okay.
So I think we should have like a week or something like that where we really try to beat the shit out of cameras, but and then repairing them and trying to do
like
that.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, like really, like not only physical violence, really like bombarding them with radiation or whatever. I think there is interesting stuff in chips and we have to find it. Thanks for your talk.
Oh, no. Wait. Where can they send the cameras? Because if someone's got a camera, where to send it?
I think I'll just set up a page or a wiki or something like that and I'll put it on the 26C3 wiki or something. Okay,
sounds
so
great.
Look into the 26C3 wiki for Audrey's talk. Okay?
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Johannes.
Next question.
Great talk. I was wondering if I could chill here for a moment for you and ask you to describe the sewing film process, because I noticed you left out something that I think a lot of people here would really appreciate, which is repurposing, say, some kinds of technology that have certain intended effects, like killing people, and instead you used it for art.
Okay, so I used your night vision goggles and started working on this project with you. So we were. What was that?
Making art instead of war.
Yes. So night vision goggles that are often used in wars to go and kill people, we use them instead to see in the dark and not put our fingers into the sewing machine. So the stitched film project, it started off with me and Jake Applebaum and our friend Mike Esty. And we were using night vision goggles and a sewing machine and just sewing together the film and shooting it in a large format camera to see what would happen.
So. Wow, sounds amazing.
There are photographs of that online, yes?
Yes, there are. I'll put them on the wiki for my talk. That'll be far less chaotic than me trying to make something happen here right now. And there is actually some photographs that my friends Ian Baker and Nicole Aptekar took of me sewing this in the dark with an infrared camera. So we set up some infrared lights. I was wearing infrared goggles or night vision goggles. And I was sewing these, and they were using an infrared camera to photograph me while I did this. So it was
a
lot of fun.
That's great. What's your question?
I found it very interesting when you talked about solarization as having been a technique, or rather an accidental process that was occurring repeatedly to a lot of the early photographers. And it seems that there was a gap between the Daguerre photograph that you showed and the Man Ray and Lee Miller photograph of some 70 years or more, or mm-hmm. maybe even 100 years, before there was a distinct occurrence of that accidental technique being used as an intentional component of the art. And I was wondering if there's anything you could elaborate about what you think the reasons for that delay were, or what it took for those artists at that time to identify that flaw and reinterpret it as an intentional thing that they could use as part of their art. Mm-hmm. And as a second part of the question, where do you think those opportunities exist now? And if so, are there any examples that you might have, or ideas or directions about that?
Okay, that's a lot to answer. But I'll try to cover all of that. So yes, there is a time gap in between that daguerreotype and the surrealists who were doing this in the beginning of the 20th century. So even though solarization definitely occurred in that time, I couldn't find any evidence of people doing it on purpose until the surrealists. So it was probably largely a cultural thing. Photography was more concerned with getting a realistic image and doing that instead of using those flaws. In the surrealist period, it was surrealism and Dada came around the same time and were described in the beginning as an anti-art movement. They were doing things sloppily on purpose. They were very much inspired by mistakes and flaws and things that happened accidentally, one of the surrealist games was called The Exquisite Corpse, and it was a writing game. They were, someone would write the beginning of a sentence, fold the paper, hand it to the next person at the table, and they would finish the sentence without knowing what the beginning of it was. So using, and then everyone would read those at the end, using accidental juxtaposition. The surrealists were much more embracing of accidental things as an expressive tool. So I want you to repeat the rest of your question there.
The second part was then, so those are the reasons that you identify as that being embraced at that point. Do you see, I mean, where are those areas now? Do they still exist? Do you still see there being opportunities for, I mean, obviously you point at the CF card flaw. Is there a generalized outlook that you can, you know, that you have identified for yourself as to how to spot those flaws and how to shift one's own thinking away from, ah, damn, I fucked it up, to, oh, well, how do I make this, how do I integrate this into my art?
Okay, well, a very general way of answering that is when you get that feeling, oh, damn, I fucked it up, just question that. If you feel like you messed something up, take another look at it and see if, even though it wasn't something you intended, is it something that's interesting? Is it interesting in any way? And what if you try to do it on purpose? What if you push that and see if it could be something more refined?
Do you identify a difference between just the accidental artifacts and artifacts that are used intentionally? I mean, how do you moderate that in your own work? Like, how do you know, I mean, do you choose to intentionally push an artifact past a certain point?
Often I do. The first step in pushing it or using it as an expressive tool is just embracing it. When it when it happens, don't throw it away.
It's such a good life lesson. I think we can all take that with us. All people who are standing can still ask their questions. No one else can because of time.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Thanks again, Audrey, for your talk. I find both your work and the talk incredibly inspiring. As we sit here at a hacker conference and as it's composed of people who, and I self-identify this way, who are nerds and geeks and who tend to focus on a kind of precision and a kind of gear fetishism, right? So we tend to want the thing that we think will help us make the best art. And photography, I think, is particularly prey to that, right? You want the
right.
fastest lens, you want the big, you know, the best ISO, etc. Do you agree?
There's
a tendency to
there's
that.
There's definitely that tendency towards super precision, a lot of gear geekery. People will want the best lens and, like, what is the best camera, the latest technology to use on this.
And so what I found so inspiring about what you're saying here, it's about both rejecting the fear of failure, but also rejecting the idea that you can blame the gear because you don't like the art that you're producing. When, in fact, you can take whichever camera you have available to you and whatever light conditions you have available to you and take your own artistic vision and make that into something that you find satisfying. And so, for instance, your experience with the concert photographs where you were taking the six exposures. So instead of, as you said, saying, wow, I'm just getting these blurry, fucked up images, it's my damn camera.
Yeah, for a while, definitely for a while, I didn't bother taking my camera to concerts because I was frustrated by the fact that there wasn't really enough light. I didn't like what really fast film looks like because often I was far away enough from the stage that the grain was overpowering the performers on the stage. And I didn't have enough control over the lighting conditions, so I just left my camera at home for a while. And then at some point I brought it out again and decided what I'm after doesn't have to be those perfect images.
Right.
What I'm capable of doing in this situation is not what is normally described as perfect, but I can still do something that's interesting. And maybe that'll end up being more interesting, at least to me, and maybe to other people as well, when it's not that perfect image.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, applause for it. Okay, the other microphone.
Hello, Audrey. Thanks for this great insight into photography and doing it wrong. I was wondering if you knew examples of other media, maybe like moving pictures, or maybe also, because we're at a hacker conference here, of computer graphics, where such things happened. I mean, for instance, I bet when people are doing 3D graphics with shader programs and everything, then you also go through many iterations till you get something to look like you want it. And I was wondering if maybe you or anyone in the audience here knew of such situations where you get something that you absolutely didn't intend, but that you afterwards pick up and find great and use it.
Okay, the first thing that comes to mind in terms of video, I can't remember the name of the musician or the artist that made this video, and maybe someone here does. They purposely used the compression of the video in it. I think they removed the keyframes, and something about the compression caused this strange warping of it. Does anyone know what this? Who is it?
Kanye West.
Kanye West.
Evident utensil?
Okay. All right, that should be enough to throw at Google and get something.
Microphone, please take this tent. What's the recommendation? Really short, please, because we're running out of time.
Jodi.org. I mean, you probably know Jodi.org, but Jodi.org, like Jodi.org. They are pretty much like the godfathers of fucking up net art. They're
yes.
from the Netherlands, and like they started like in the mid-1990s of like creating websites that were completely fucked up and messed up. So go to jodi.org and check it out on Wikipedia. They are really awesome.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for answering that. Last question.
Yeah, the question was where to begin with such a fragmenting.
I'm
sorry.
I'm having some trouble hearing.
Yes.
I'm sorry, this is pretty much uncomfortable. The question was earlier how to start when one doesn't know a place, how to begin with. And I have made these funny images with the laser pointers and pointing into my lens in long exposures, and also using laser pointers on big frame film. Mm-hmm. So I want to suggest that to whoever asked it before.
I missed that last part, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, do you have someone with you who can translate?
I'm sorry, I can't help it. I wanted to suggest using laser pointers on your lens as a starting point when you want to create images that look strangely broken in some way.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's much fun.
Okay, so have you done those?
Yes.
I would like to see. So send me an email. Woo!
A very brief thing that occurs he's proposing using laser pointers directed at the lens, and for all of those of you who saw the recent Star Trek reboot film, there are lens flares
abound in that movie. And J.J. Abrams, the producer and director of that film, specifically had his cinematographer and their assistants shining high-intensity flashlights at the camera so that they could generate his vision for the future of this Star Trek series was going to be one that just always had something amazing illuminating just out of frame. So if you watch that movie, look for all the lens flares. They're ridiculous. They're like 3 or 4 or 5 in every scene, sometimes absolutely obscuring people's face. So a lens flare would be an example of something that's a flaw, mm-hmm. and typically avoided. But in the context of that film, he chose. Yes, I'll put it on the wiki. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
The second part of what I was saying earlier was that you can use laser pointers on film, on big-sized film, to write or paint on that, which makes interesting images if you put it into the chemicals later then. Cool.
Thanks for this trick.
Thank you.
So cool. Give it up for Audrey. Okay, and in the meanwhile, this is the end of this presentation, but even though it's almost over, there's still so much going on. People who've got a party and know of a party, please go to the mic and share them with us. What kind of parties are there tonight and tomorrow? Share them.
Is that okay? Hello?
Everybody, Chantal, come back here. I apologize. This is personally a failing of mine as a Herald co-archangel with Sven. And so, everybody, could you give Chantal a round of applause? She's been doing a great job with Q&A throughout the talk. And then another round. While I'm up here telling jokes and being a clown, Sven here, my Herald co-archangel, has been doing all of the work of getting all the Herald angels in the right place. Give him a round of applause.